Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Many thanks for your emails, many thanks for your thoughts and suggestions about this show. I'm working on your guest suggestions. And if you're listening on any kind of mobile device, maybe a phone, or if you've downloaded shows to your iPod, or if you're listening any other way, please, when you get near a computer, go to the website www.theunexplained.tv, register a hit on the website, send me an email, give me your feedback and suggestions about the show, because that's how we grow and develop it. And if you'd like to, please hit the donate button. And if you can make a donation to the running of this show, that would be fabulous and would help us to keep this work going and to do all the developments that I want to get into during this year of 2013. The website, designed and created by Adam Cornwell from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, the man who gets the show out to you. Very hard-working guy. This time round, it is going to be a big show with a man who you suggested we have on. Now, I have to say, I'd never heard his name, and that's my fault, because I just haven't come across it over these years, but I certainly have now. His name is Dr. Barry Taff, and this guy is a kind of one-stop-shop researcher in all things paranormal, and I'm talking about poltergeists and ghosts and UFOs and abductions and aliens and telepathy and psychokinesis and goodness knows what else. I don't normally read biographies on the show like this. I normally just give you my own little snapshot, but I will. It's just a quick one. Dr. Barry Taff earned a doctorate in psychophysiology from UCLA. He's got 6 medical patents, and from 1969 to 1978, he worked in the parapsychology lab at UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute as a research associate, where he studied telepathy, precognition, remote viewing, poltergeist, doppelgangers, and UFOs. Wow. His research has been published in numerous journals, periodicals, magazines, and books over the last 25 years. He's got a book out right now, by the way. He's been the principal investigator on more than 3,500 cases of poltergeists and hauntings, one of which, and you'll know this, became the best-selling book and picture, The Entity. This is one of the people behind that. Dr. Barry Taff, our guest here at The Unexplained from the United States. Like I say, please keep your feedback coming. Utterly vital for what we do here. And thank you so much for your support and the nice things you say about the show. If this show needs to be improved, let me know by email and I can do something about it. Okay, let's cross to the United States now. Dr. Barry Taff, a first-time guest on The Unexplained. And Barry, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure to be here.
Now, Barry, whereabouts are you? I believe you're in California. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm in Los Angeles, just literally about 2 blocks south of Beverly Hills.
Okay, and that is where most of your career, certainly going back to the 1960s, that's where you've kind of been based, isn't it?
Yes, I've lived in Los Angeles. My parents and I came out here from Chicago in 1957, and I've been here ever since. And I can't imagine what my life would have been like had I stayed in Chicago, because, you know, being in the Midwest, it's a more conservative environment. I don't think they would have been as tolerant as this environment was to what I've been doing.
Well, certainly, if you look at the smorgasbord of things that you've been into, I can't think of anywhere else really on this planet that would have been more conducive to your work and your research.
Yeah, it was the right place at the right time.
And the right guy. We in the media always try and put labels on people. We like to be able to find a nice little one-sentence description. It's very hard for me to do that with you because of the whole variety of work that you've done and the variety of fields since the 1960s that you've researched in. So I thought, if you don't mind, we might cherry-pick across some of those fields and then also, of course, talk about your latest work. And we have to talk about your involvement with The Entity. But I wanted to just get into something first off, if I may, that I discovered on your website. And it's something that I've heard people talk about, but I've never actually seen anybody write about. Maybe I've just been looking in the wrong places. You've done some work about psychosis and paranormality. And basically the work suggests that those who are most prone to paranormal experiences may have mental trauma or mental disturbance. Is that correct?
Well, no, I think you're somewhat misinterpreting, and this has been a common problem since I published that blog.
Okay.
The blog is called Science Psychosis, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid. And what I think is going on from my work of 44 years in the field is, because there are no boundaries to this area, we don't have a lot of super hard facts, and what facts there are few and far between, it tends to attract the likeness of people who are emotionally unstable or troubled because they think they're going to find answers to their personal problems in the paranormal, in parapsychology. Because, well, it must be with the spirit and the mind. And, yeah, it deals with consciousness. It deals with energies of the type we're not readily familiar with today. But it is no more a provider of answers in the end, at least now, than it was in the 19th century when it began as in the Society for Psychical Research in London in 1882. The problem is it's the same way a lot of people, when they become stressed or disturbed or troubled, they seek out a better knowledge. Usually they go to God, which sometimes is very good because it brings them closure and groundedness. It gives them comfort and peace of mind, which is what everybody wants. And a lot of people think, well, if God doesn't do it, let's go to the paranormal. Or they start out with the paranormal, and then they go to God because they're looking for answers. And unfortunately, the answers we're getting are not answering all the questions that are out there.
Well, I can just think of the number of books that I've read and documentaries that I've seen about either movie stars or rock stars. And the people who've known them, if it's all ended very badly for them, they say, well, of course, at the end, whoever it might be discovered God or started playing with a Ouija board or discovered the paranormal or started seeing things. And so that connection is there to be made, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, I worked a lot in the entertainment industry on different films and met a lot of actors and directors. And I know a few who I've known for many decades who are very stable and normal, no drugs, no alcohol. They're really good people who are creative, and they want to bring their creativity to the world to make people feel better. But other people, what I'm hearing and seeing is it's an escape. They don't like who they are. Sometimes they even hate who they are. And they then think, well, if I'm acting, I become someone else, and I don't worry about this other problem. And I asked them over the course of time, I said, well, what made you want to become an actor? And invariably, the response I've gotten is, well, I hate myself, and when I act, I don't think about how much I hate myself in my life, so I feel better. That's a very sad commentary to go over, because, I mean, with all the wonderful things there are to do in the world, and the great things to accomplish, and all the great things to help people and make the world a better place, part of that is if by writing a song, performing it, making a movie or a TV show, you inspire people, you motivate them, you incentivize them, it's like you've improved their world. And that's what one of the reasons I'm in it. For example, I want to leave a legacy, not that I just did this, because that's not the point. I want to contribute something to humanity. So when I'm gone, he helped us understand a little more than we did, but when we started, I brought knowledge and wisdom and understanding and, I guess, grounding. If we can't eventually put what we're learning to use in this field, then why are we doing it?
Barry, would you suggest that anybody who had, you know, a lot of people who go to psychics, for example, they're questing for something. And as you've just said, a lot of people who get involved in the paranormal have some kind of lacking within their lives, and they're trying to fill or plug a gap, fill a hole of some kind. Would you advise anybody with any issues not to get involved in the paranormal, not to start researching it and not to have anything to do with it until they've sorted themselves out first?
It depends. It's a very subjective matter here, Howard. Basically, it's depending on the individual, depending on their own personal reasons. The reason that got me into this were twofold. One reason was I was having these experiences growing up, telepathic, precognitive, out of body, clairvoyant, whatever. I thought they were normal. I thought everyone had them. The other reason is curiosity. I was reading books, textbooks, and written by scholars in this area, qualified people, and I was going, this is amazing. So my question to myself was, why am I having these experiences when my friends and family are not? And I had to make the decision, well, either I'm normal, I'm crazy, everyone else is normal, or it's somewhere in the middle, Many people may have these experiences, but they choose to ignore them, or they just don't give a damn because they're too busy living their life.
Did you feel that you were special or singled out to have these experiences?
No, not at all. No.
So you felt that everybody had, even from an early age, you felt that other people, everybody perhaps, has the potential to have paranormal experiences?
I didn't feel one way or the other hard. What I basically felt was that something extraordinary is happening to me, and it's not being shared by my family and friends. Why?
When you say extraordinary, what sorts of things were happening to you?
Well, an example. I could close my eyes and image people I knew that I wasn't with, and I could describe what they were doing, what they're saying. When JFK was inaugurated, when he won the presidency in 1960, he was inaugurated in 61, I kept having this vivid image of him being killed. I didn't say he died. I said he was killed right near Thanksgiving in 63, and I bet my father $25, which in those days was a lot of money, that this would happen. My father did right. Okay, I'll bet you. And then when it happened, unfortunately, my father paid me the money, and my parents didn't speak to me for weeks.
Why didn't you tell the FBI?
Well, because I was a kid. Okay. I was 12 years old when this happened.
Hmm. And they wouldn't, in all probability...
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, well, I having this image. I didn't know where. I didn't know when. Hmm. I didn't know why. All I knew was what.
Did it disturb
right around
you? Thanksgiving did it leave you disturbed? Did you feel disturbed?
It troubled me because what do you do about it? Let me give you another example. In 1975, I was lived with a girlfriend and I were together. And, okay, we're together. I'm dreaming during sleep. I'm piloting a 747 airliner. Now, I've been a pilot most of my life, but I'm not a commercial pilot or an Air Force pilot. But I've got a license. I know a lot about aviation. So in the dream, I'm flying a 747. Don't ask me how. I knew it was CWA. Maybe the red and white. And we're approaching South Africa, and I didn't know how I knew that, because you don't fly high enough, you don't cruise at high enough altitude to see Continental Divide or features. And suddenly in my dream, the turbofans go dark, go quiet. The drone is gone. The panels in the cockpit go dark, and we're dropping like a lead balloon. We hit, explode. I come blowing out of bed. I'm screaming. I'm sweating. And my girlfriend, Darlene, said, "What happened?" I said, "I just crashed in a 747. So I did some research the next day or so, and it determined that they just came out not that long before that. And they were a relatively new plane. And of course, their performance record was superb. And I thought, what am I supposed to do? I don't know when it's going to happen. I did nothing. What am I, you know? So a few days later, the first 747 went down on approach to South Africa, and it was a TWA.
Really?
Now, if it happened today, and they called the FAA, I'd be in jail. They'd assume I brought the plane down. How could you have known it otherwise?
This is a pretty common experience, I think. I can remember I was doing news on one of the big commercial stations here in the UK around the time of 9/11. And it was either the night before, or I think probably two, three nights before, I had an extremely disturbing dream about a silver plane, a passenger plane, sliding out of the sky and crashing into a field, which of course happened in Pennsylvania. And what I saw in my dream, subsequent documentaries that I saw a year or two later, and I was heavily involved in the story of 9/11. I even went to New York to Ground Zero. But what I later came to learn was that the way that that plane came out of the sky was what I'd seen in a dream. And that is one of a number of experiences that I've had, so they must be pretty common.
Yeah, they're common. The question is, do people remember them and do they act upon them? Now, last year, not long before Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast, I had a terrible series of dreams. In the dreams, fierce torrential wind, torrential rain, and a horrible flooding. And I live in here, Los Angeles. I mean, we don't get that hardly ever. And in my dream, I'm looking out of my window. I'm on the second floor, and I see that the water's up three-quarters of the way to my door. Everything's flooded, and I thought, oh, my God, my car's underwater. What will I do? And I can't leave the house. And I thought, this is a very disturbing dream. It felt real. And, of course, a few days later, Sandy hit. But I didn't see the East Coast. All I saw was heavy rain, torrential rain, horrible flooding, and a lot of wind. So that in itself isn't sufficient. If I felt the date, or I said it's going to hit the East Coast, and I said like New York, New Jersey, the whole different thing. So it's too generic. But the 747 was not generic. But again, if it was today and the dream came up and I contact the FAA, I'd be in jail right now.
Yeah, true enough. And, you know, just...
And so what do you do?
From the point of view of being believed is the first question. And then, of course, being suspected is the second question. Are there diagnostic tools that people who are prone to these things, and some people are more prone to them than others, aren't they? Are there tools that people can use to be more specific about them, to verify them?
Well, here's the problem. Precognition, you know, seeing things that have not yet occurred, seeing the future, assuming it's real, that it's usually there's a lot of noise in the signal. What I mean by that is we sometimes cloak things, we cover up things that are very emotionally painful for us in a way so we can deal with them emotionally. An example, when I was in upper division college, I was dating a girl named Sharon, beautiful blue-eyed blonde. I mentioned her in my book. Everything was going really well, and suddenly the dreams came. In the dreams, we're driving to her house, and she lived in a cul-de-sac and in the San Fernando Valley, and a dark car flew out at us, hit us head-on, horrible accident. She was broken and bloody. Now, I didn't see the driver. I didn't see the dash, but I assumed it was me because he had dark hair. And I said, well, this isn't good. So I told Sharon, look, this is the dream I'm having, and I can't see you anymore. And she thought I was lying because I didn't want to drive out all the way to Northridge or to San Fernando Valley. Gas was 28 cents a gallon back then. Like, who cares? I said, no, it's not worth our lives. I won't risk our lives for this. What's the point? She got really upset. Relationship ended. So some time goes by, maybe 2 months. She starts dating someone else. And everything I saw was correct. The accident, where it occurred, the driver was killed instantly. She was badly injured. I didn't change anything. I misinterpreted what I saw. I put my own ego put me in the driver's seat.
Let's just back up very slightly on this. Did you tell her the reason why you had to break up with her? Did you tell her about the dream?
Yes, I did.
So she knew that thing was coming. So God knows what she must have felt. Did she ever tell you when it actually happened?
She didn't believe me at all. She thought I was making this up.
But when it did happen, she must have instantly thought about you, mustn't she?
And she would not talk to me anymore. She refused to.
And that was because she felt that perhaps you were tapped into something really bad.
That's partially correct, Howard. She said that she didn't like the fact that I couldn't intervene. And I said, what could I do? I said, I thought it was us, and by me not being involved with her, that it wouldn't happen. No, it wasn't us. It was her. She was what I really saw. The guy never saw the guy's face. All I saw was thick, dark hair, which is what I had at the time. Another instance. In early college, a neighbor of mine, we were trading off driving back and forth to college because we had similar schedules. He would drive one day, I would drive another. So we're going to school, and he drove a 68 Plymouth Barracuda, like a salmon color.
Yeah.
Ugly car. Just anyway, we're driving, and his name was Sandy. I said, Sandy, we've got to stop the car. He goes, why? We're going to get hit by a car. It's a red 1966 T-Bird with a beige interior. The woman driving it, a black beehive hairdo, and we're going to get T-boned. And he goes, what? I go, can you just stop the car? Can we get a cup of coffee? He goes, no. Are you out of your mind? I go, look, stop the car or let me out. No. So I buckled the old-fashioned shoulder harness. They weren't like they are today. That was since 68. And suddenly, bang, we're T-boned. There's the T-bird. There's the woman in the car. The color was right. He never spoke to me again.
And how did you feel about yourself then? Did you feel that you were some kind of magnet for bad things?
No, I tend to perceive those things that pose threats to me, which is a common precognition often is perceived when it poses threats, a danger.
That's absolutely true, and it doesn't have to be in a dream, does it? I can remember, it's 10 years ago now, but I've been doing a radio show in Italy, and we had to fly back from Pisa, from near Pisa, and we were flying British Airways. And, you know, we'd had a good week. It was fine. We were all very chilled and relaxed. The production team flying back to London. What was not to like? So we're sitting back and I'm just anticipating a really nice flight. Going to have some nice dinner and you know how it is. And suddenly, as we started taxiing for takeoff, I thought something is going to go wrong with this takeoff, but we're going to be all right. About 15 seconds later, the plane, which was just about at that V1 point, you know, the point where the pilot lifts the nose off the ground?
Rotation, yeah.
Rotate, exactly. Rotate V1. We started to lift off the ground just a few feet, and then suddenly he slammed the brakes on. We came to a grinding halt, a tire burst, people screamed, baggage started pouring out of lockers. But I had known what was going to happen. That's exactly what did happen. The takeoff was aborted, but we were all okay. I mean, we were delayed for about 6 hours after that till they got another plane for us. I knew that was going to happen. And I still don't know how.
Yeah, it is real common. My ability is focused in two areas. One, okay, the only readings I've ever given people are either medical, diagnostic, or criminal. I hate it when people prey upon others. I hate criminals. I have low tolerance, and I want to help people. That's why I'm in this field. Since I was a kid, I've been able to diagnose people medically. Now they call it a medical intuitive. And this, I can do this quite easily. When The Dark Knight came out 4 years ago, five, whatever, yeah, I went to a screening of it at the Directors Guild here in Los Angeles. And so I was with an old friend from UCLA. You know, I haven't been around her in years. I never knew her that well. But she drove there. I drove there separately. So we're seated, and the movie starts. And suddenly, my bladder feels like it's going to explode, burning, horrible pain. She gets her phone call. Her cell phone rings. She's got to leave. Her daughter had a problem. So she leaves. I stayed. And the minute she leaves, I'm fine. Turns out she had a really bad bladder infection. I said, next time you tell me, you don't let me sit next to you. Another time, when I was lecturing in 98 with one of my colleagues in Anaheim, California, an old girlfriend showed up and looked very nice, beautiful, very little signs of age. I hadn't seen her in like 18 years. And she seemed a little odd, came up to me and my colleague and made some really weird statements, but that's not weird. I discussed this in my book. Well, I don't discuss it in my book. She showed up not long thereafter at my home and wouldn't let her in because I felt there was something wrong with her. She sounded suicidal. I said, you need psychiatric help. You sound like you're ready to commit suicide. And anyway, I won't go into that because that's very depressing. But what I will mention is it was a very warm day. It was late spring of 1999, and it was wearing a halter top. And I'm talking to her, and I said, Linda, what's all over your chest? She goes, what? I go, it looks like a jellyfish. What I said, I got closer to her. Oh, Linda, you better go see an oncologist. Your breasts are riddled with tumors. She went, what? I go, go have some mammograms done. Your breasts are riddled with tumors. Now, she knew me from way back when, and she went like, what? I go, just go have a checkup. So months later, she gets back to me. Yep, her breasts were riddled with tumors. She had to have a radical mastectomy and reconstructive surgery. But I said, I thought it was so vivid. I thought it was on her rather than in her.
But at least you were aware of a problem, I mean, and you were able to alert her to that problem. You were the whistleblower on the problem, and you were able to get her to go and get help. Right. I would imagine if you have, I don't know whether I can call this a gift, but if you have an ability like that, you have to gauge very carefully, number one, whether you should tell them, and number two, you have to also gauge how they might react if you do tell them.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Another example, about 10 years ago, this girl moved in my building, tall, lanky, blonde, blue-eyed, and I had looked at her, and she looked nice, but I had an instant dislike of her. I just got a really bad feeling this woman was psychotic. I looked at her. It was very disturbing. I didn't know her, and I told some friends in the building that she's going to be evicted. They go, she just moved in. I said, look, I'm telling you, there's something wrong with this woman. They go, what do you mean? I said, look at her. They go, what do you mean, look at her? I said, look at her. Okay, so time goes by. I won't bore you with the details because they're not relevant. She's evicted. Starting harassing a number of tenants, one of whom was me. So they said, how did you know? I said, how could you not know? Look at her. And, you know, like what? They don't know what I'm talking about. This, I remember, when I'm around people who are epileptic, I get dizzy and I even pass out. Back in junior high school, I'd, you know, be with friends, and this girl named Helene would come up behind me, and I wouldn't even know it, and I'd get dizzy and I'd black out. I was lecturing on the Queen Mary night in 2006, the end of it, and I shook hands with one of the organizers of the event, and the room started to spin. I backed away, found out she was epileptic. I was working with a man in the mid-90s. I met him named Mark. He looked normal, very bright, nice guy. I shook his hand, and I go, oh, my God. What? I said, I can't stand within 10 feet of you. You're epileptic. How did you know? I said, I feel like I'm going to pass out.
And Barry, where do you think this is coming from? Are you tapping into the person Or are you tapping into something that is divine and above the person?
I'm accessing information. Why I'm able to, why my ability seems to be so heavily focused on the medical, I can't tell you. This has been, I've lived with this my whole life. This has got me in tremendous trouble when I was a child in grammar school.
I can believe
it. In the fifth grade, you're 10 years old. Mm. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I spoke of this on Coast to Coast and at my lecture. It's recess, and we're playing Foursquare. And this little blonde girl named Christine is walking towards me, and I'm looking at her. And it was like color x-ray vision, the best way I could describe it. I clearly see under her blue dress, there's a bag on her right side and a tube going into her. I'm 10 years old. I didn't know what a colostomy was. I went up to her. I said, Chris, what's that weird plastic bag and tube for?
Oh, my God.
She went crazy. She started screaming, ran and got the teacher, brought me to the principal's office. They asked, did you look under her dress or did you
Lord. Speak
to the girl's bathroom? Mm. I said, I did neither. It just came on. He goes, what do you mean it came on? It's like x-ray vision. He goes, yeah, right. So I'm looking at the principal. I said, you've got that a scar from your appendix surgery that never healed all that well. It's always purple. And he turned purple.
Gee.
He called my parents and said, what is he? And they said, don't ask. Just don't ask.
I'm amazed they didn't say this kid is cursed.
Well, they asked my parents, and he said to me, I don't want to hear of this happening again while you're in school. You're not going to be here very long.
You must be a very strong person, though, from childhood, because a lot of us would start to feel, we'd start to feel bad. We'd start to feel unclean. We'd start to feel wrong. And you, you obviously
Why?
Didn't.
I mean,
well, if people are telling you that what you're doing is not a great thing, and if they're horrified
at
those things.
They didn't say that. They were frightened by it.
They were horrified by it.
Yeah, because, if more people did this, if this was a commonly understood mechanism within people, he's a good sportsman. He can play better football. He's a better soccer player. He's a better basketball player. But you're a better medical intuitive? Like, what?
So one of two things can happen, can't they, if you're in that situation and you're young? Number one, you either think you're terrible, or number two, you start to think of yourself as the Messiah.
I didn't know. I didn't. With me, there was a third. I just questioned, what am I doing and how? The peripheral societal elements of it never concerned me. What am I doing and how am I doing? In the study that was run on me at UCLA, 1969-1970, by Dr. Thelma Moth, there are clear indicators of my medical intuitive abilities in that study. It was published in a journal in 75. And, so you can do it. How do you do it, and why you versus anyone else? I don't look at myself as... The only thing I can tell you for sure is that the older I get, the less I have in common with more people.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
Focused.
That makes you unique.
No, it's just most people have a job and they have their life. Mm-hmm. My life and my work and my job are all part of much the same thing. I mean, other than the parapsychology research, the only other things I'm really interested in, I've done a lot of writing for the entertainment industry. And also, I like writing, written my book and things like that. But I'm also an inventor. I have 6 medical patents.
Yeah, no, that's in your biography. What are those? And your abilities, I'm trying to find a word for them, but your divining abilities, did they have any part in the medical patents that you got?
No, I started studying some things in graduate school. I was reading a lot of literature from China and Japan and Russia, and I was intrigued by what I was hearing and seeing, so I decided to do some experiments with technology and... I was studying acupuncture. I was fascinated by electroacupuncture. So I was studying it, and what I learned was that you could build a machine, an electronic device, to measure acupuncture points very reliably. They're they have higher voltage, lower resistance than normal points on the skin. And by monitoring these points electronically, you can detect the existence, the approach and occurrence of various illnesses, disorders, and disease long before symptomology appears. So that, and then I developed some other patents along the way. One of the last patents I got is nothing to do with acupuncture, like in the original Star Trek series, where you lay on the bed and your vital signs are read out above you on a screen without any electrodes. I have a device called a cryogenic remote sensing physiograph, CRESP. Measures ultra-low frequency, extremely low frequency emitted by human bodies. You can measure EEG, ECG, electrocardiograms, and respiration without any electrodes from up to 12 feet away.
And do you feel that you're a kind of human version of that machine because you can do what it does?
No.
You sense what people have.
I don't know. Again, as Mr. Spock would like to say in the original Star Trek series, one does not speculate without facts. I don't know what the hell's going on. All I know is I've been able to do this. I can still do it. I'm looking for information over a long period of time, longitudinal data patterns.
And you spent 9 years as a researcher at UCLA and being researched at UCLA. The range of things that you went into there, according to your biography, poltergeists, doppelgangers, UFOs, precognition, remote viewing, of all of those things that you did, which was the most interesting and which was the most, in inverted commas, paranormal?
They all were fascinating. What I talk about on my website, what I think we've discovered, not just me but other researchers, academic researchers in the field, regarding remote viewing, what we used to call telepathy and clairvoyance and precognition, is that when it comes to this type of information, there is no space, there is no time. The past information still exists. The future's information already exists. The information at a distance is always everywhere. Sort of like a hologram. If you cut a normal picture in pieces, you get a little piece of the original. Cut a hologram in pieces, each piece can recreate the whole. This is what I think is going on regarding the paranormal in terms of the way we access information across space and time. And now there's good evidence suggesting that our own memories, our own long-term memories, may not be stored in our own brain. And the doctor that spent 2 decades investigating this at Caltech, they fired him because they didn't like what he was saying, even though he could clinically demonstrate it.
So what you're saying, that we have cloud computing now where all of our data is stored somewhere else, you're saying that actually as human beings we work that way too?
Yes, evidence strongly indicates that the way we're designed to recover our own memories is a remote viewing process. And if that's how we're designed, this is where we're made to work, then it's no surprise we can perceive things across space and time. This is normal.
Are you aware of the work of Major Ed Dames? Have you heard of Major Ed Dames?
Yes, I know who he is.
Okay, well, Major Ed Dames talks about some kind of universal consciousness, and the remote viewer taps into this universal consciousness, and that's how the great trick of remote viewing, trick's the bad word, but the great gambit, the great exercise of remote viewing, that's how it happens. You tap into this thing.
In science, your theory must conform to your data. You don't make your data fit your theory. That's backward science. If you look at all the data in psychical research and then parapsychology, there are clear trends and patterns. And if you look at, you evaluate them correctly with enough of a broad scope, it's somewhat obvious that we're looking at information that is what's called space-like and time-like, which means that space and time don't affect it. But that implies that the future that makes up the information that makes up the future may still exist. They already exist. The information that makes the past still exists. But what if the information that makes up our future already exists? Then what? Well, that means the future is already there. Well, do we have free will? Is it a mixture of free will and determinism? We don't know.
But what we do know, if that is true, what we do know is the future is there to be discovered ahead of time.
We sort of flow into it the same way water will take up the shape of the glass.
But it's also there to be discovered ahead of time. If it's there already, if the elements for it are there already, then that lays the foundation for somebody.
And whether we can act upon it. The one film that changed my life when I was a kid growing up, 1960, The Time Machine, not the remake.
Great movie. 80,
Yeah, the original with Rod Taylor.
Yes, fantastic movie.
Great line that Rod Taylor says, "Can man control his destiny? Can he change the shape of things to come? That is the most important question to which I hope to find an answer." And that is a question that has plagued the human condition since day one. My gut is telling me, and the evidence suggests, that the future may be as immutable as the past is. The problem is we can't prove or disprove it because we're part of it.
And the problem also is, as human beings, we are flawed, and we're not as, you know, we're not superhuman. We're not as able as we might be. And the problem is the people who do remote viewing and remote view the future. And Ed Dames is one of those people. He's been remarkably accurate on some things.
Well, the problem is it looks in terms of information theory, it has a low signal to noise ratio. A lot of times people don't know when to stop talking. Just shut their mouth and stop babbling. You know, I'm trying to think. I don't make prognostications. I don't make predictions. I get feelings. I talk of them to people. Things that are sometimes are overwhelming. Things are subtle. Things about people I know. I have close friends, and they're doing things. And I told this one of my friends, Michael, and I said, "Look, Michael, I've got a feeling you're wasting your time. Nothing's going to happen with what you're doing." And it's been 18 years, and still nothing's happened. I go, "What? You're wasting. These people are criminals." And he almost got arrested recently because what they were doing with him was illegal, and they got nailed for it.
Now, so, did you know that? Because you'd sensed that from your psychic sense? Or did you know that just because you know the guy and you're aware of what he's going through?
I don't know him that well. He used to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force. He's a generation younger than me. And I didn't even know the people he had was working with. But also, there's other people I was working with from the East Coast several years ago. And one of them I've talked to a dozen times, the other one only twice. The guy I spoke to only twice, I got cold chills when he spoke to me. And I told the main guy, I said, his name was Vincent. I said, "Look, this other man you're speaking to is not who and what he claims to be. There's something wrong with him. He's a liar. He's doing something illegal that's going to end up putting you guys in jail." They were both arrested. My friend Vinny was let go. But the other guy was held because what he was trying to do would have put everybody behind bars. And they deported him. He claimed he was from Greece. He was actually from the Middle East.
Barry, your ability to do this, is it selective? In other words, is it only certain people you can do it for, or could you, if you'd wanted to, set yourself up as somebody who does readings and do that for anyone?
The only readings I've ever given, the only two things I'm good at that I know work for me are medical or criminal. I don't care about when a guy's going to meet his next girlfriend, when a woman's going to meet her next boyfriend, where they're going to close another big deal. It's irrelevant. Those are minutiae of life. I'm concerned, are you physically healthy? Because if your health is bad, life is hell. Mm. And then, are you being preyed upon? Is someone hurting you or harming you, trying to steal your money or something? So I'm trying to help people, and there's a New Age guru in Malibu out here. And he wanted to know if I do readings. So I told him what I do. He goes, "Oh, no, way too serious." They want to know when they're going to next make their next money, like movie deal or book deal. I go, "Oh, please." Or the next boyfriend or girlfriend. I said, "I really don't care about that. My brain doesn't give a damn."
But most of us want to be nice, don't we? So it's very hard to say to people, if you know them, "I'm sorry, I can't help you," isn't it? It must be very hard.
This woman I've known since the 80s came by with her boyfriend about a year ago, and she said she had problems. I go, "Don't medical problems." I said, "Don't tell me a thing." So I'm doing my thing, and I said to her, "There's nothing wrong with you. I described your symptoms, and I said, you're getting old, like everyone else. There's nothing medically wrong." I said, "No offense, but," I said, "you're drinking too much wine. It's metabolized your sugar, blah, blah, blah. And your symptoms are indicative of the early onset of menopause."
Did she speak to you after that?
Yeah, she did, but she was freaked out.
Oh, I can imagine she was.
Real girlfriend I had, not just someone I dated, I met her quite a long time ago, and she lived about 40 miles away, which is no big deal. And we were together, everything was fine. And then every time I was with her, after about 2 months, I started getting sick. And I said to her, her name was Judy, "Look, Judy, I really like you, we get along, I enjoy being with you, but you're falling apart, you've got a prolapsed mitral valve." She goes, "A what?" I said, "A prolapsed mitral valve." She says, "No, it's your heart, okay." And I said, "You've got some upper respiratory distress. You also have the early onset of menopause." Turns out I was right, and That was the end of that.
Gee whiz.
So I was set up on a blind date by a good friend of mine, a filmmaker named Jose Escamilla. Really nice. Good home for like 33 years. So set me up with a beautiful girl named Jody, 1983. We're having dinner. And she said, Jose said you're psychic. Like, what can you do? And I went, well, I can diagnose people. What's wrong with me? I said, you don't want to know, Jody. She said, no, I want to know. Okay. Well, you have a follicular. I said, you have a follicular cyst on your left ovary. You have endometriosis. You have some lower GI problems. She goes, endo what? Follicular what? I wrote it out for her. She went to her OBGYN. They ran the tests. The doctor calls me, how did you see this? I said, I can't explain it. I just do it.
But my more skeptical listeners, Barry, would say, well, maybe of a certain age, 15%, maybe 20% of women have something like that.
Well, yes, but here's the thing. Back in the late 60s, my mom came to me and she said, look, your dad's got a problem. Can you tell us what's wrong with him? So I said to my mom, is it visibly discernible? Meaning that if I'm with him, can I see it? He goes, no. So I'm sitting next to him, and I said, you have a hiatal hernia. She turned white. He turned red. Yeah, you're right. My mom said, you guessed. I said, I only said one thing, and I was right. So, also, how many people have a prolapsed mitral valve with this old girlfriend of mine? It's whatever. I mean, how many coincidences make a fact is what it comes down to in the end.
And when it happens all the time, and when you've got a pretty high average of being correct, then you know you're dealing with something. I want to get you onto the entity and the research that led up to that, because you were involved in that movie. And, of course, the real-life case that that movie was based on. Talk to me about that.
Okay. In 1974, my colleague at the time was in Hunter's Books at Westwood, and he's talking with a friend about our research. So on the next aisle, this woman says to my old colleague, oh, my house is haunted. He goes, look, okay, give me your name and number. We'll come out and talk to you. So we go out to see her on August 22nd, 1974. It was a very muggy, hot day, very oppressive. And go in the house. There's a horrible stench of decomposing organic matter. The bedroom was ice cold, but with no air conditioning. The first thing she says right off the bat is that she had been repeatedly raped by a ghost. And we went, oh, yeah, right. Rolled her eyes back. We excused herself. I suggested she see a psychiatrist at UCLA where we worked. And that was the end of it. A few days later, about a week to 10 days later, she called us. Some neighbors and friends had witnessed things. Okay, we come back. This is in Culver City, California, on Braddock Drive. So we go in there, still hot. You know, humid. The house is colder for no reason. The stench is there. While interviewing her in the kitchen, the cupboard door flies open and an iron skillet flies out across the kitchen and slams into the floor.
Gee.
So we check for wires or springs or animals or kids. No. Now, she had four children, three boys and a girl. She claimed that there were three entities. There were two smaller ones that held her down and the one big one that raped her. The case evolved into something extraordinary. We began seeing these incredible, I don't know, corpuscular masses of light, I call them. They looked like green jello undulating, emitting bright green light, zipping around the room. We caught some photos of these. These are on my website. They're in my book.
So what would you call those, ectoplasm or orbs or what?
They looked like liquid light. I call them corpuscular masses because they seem to have a liquid more like plasma than anything else.
And throughout this process of discovering this scary stuff, you were absolutely convinced that what you were dealing with was genuine phenomena and you were not being set up.
Well, we sealed the house off from all external light sources and we looked in every nook and cranny, and this wasn't fake. The fuse box was torn out of the wall and thrown at Doris Byther. Candelabras flew at her. At one point, with 27 people in her little bedroom in Culver City, California, the green lights coalesced in the corner and formed a large apparition from the waist up. Really big guy. I'd say well over 6 feet, maybe close to seven. You could see the head, the brow ridge, the chin.
And you saw this?
Pectoral. Yeah, we all saw it. And then pop, like a light going off. So I said to everybody, don't talk. Write down what you saw. See, we all wrote down what we saw. We all saw the same thing. But then we discovered that our cameras couldn't photograph what we all saw, which is impossible.
Well, there'll be skeptics who say that's very convenient.
Well, but also, here is the point. Okay, we do know that weak electromagnetic fields can make people have visual and auditory hallucinations. Dr. Michael Persinger has demonstrated that, as of others.
Right.
Fine. If that was occurring, which I don't believe it was, but if that was occurring, it's unlikely that more than one person would have the same hallucination at the same time. Why? That's not the way our brains are wired to work. The fact that 27 people saw the same thing at the same time, what is that telling us? And then we got one picture of an orb of light, a mass of light with a tail on it. It looked like a comet. But we had no reference. So we couldn't tell where it was coming from or going to or the speed at which it was traveling. No reference. So we put up black poster boards on her walls and ceiling in her bedroom with duct tape, forming a grid. And each grid had a number and a magnetic orientation so we could tell where it was. And at one point, something in the room tore the duct tape off in front of our face and threw one of the boards at Doris's feet.
Were you scared?
Startled. It takes a lot to scare me. I used to race cars professionally, road race cars, at 180 miles an hour. If that doesn't scare you, nothing will.
But did you not have the feeling that at some point this thing or set of things is going to kill us?
No. I'm scared of real things I know about. I'm scared of crazy people with guns and knives, crazy people who commit crimes. That's frightening. This stuff... the probability of this stuff harming people is the probability of winning a Powerball Mega Millions lottery every time you play. People, fear is real, and people have extraordinary panic responses, fight or flight reactions to things they don't understand. We know that. The question is, what is going on? How is it happening? And why is it happening? And what we've learned is extraordinary. In the entity case, okay, as in others, she claimed there were three male entities, okay? There were three male children, two younger, smaller ones, and one bigger, older one. In real life, she had two younger children, one bigger one. She was kind of messed up emotionally and sexually, abused by her father and other female members of her family. She was disinherited from her family at a very young age. Substance abuse problems. Okay, explain some of it. But it wouldn't explain what we visually observed and what we documented there. And this is the problem. Today, when we run into cases where the people are clearly disturbed or there's some massive substance abuse, we walk away. But today, we have a suite of instruments we take out, geomagnetometers, low-frequency spectrum analyzers, air ion counters, thermal imaging, a whole slew of instruments. And what we're seeing is very consistent from case to case to case. The faces and places may change, but the events do not.
So, Barry, this case, this entity case, for those of us on this side of the Atlantic, how did it play out? What happened in the end?
It kept happening. Doris Spicer, the name of the lady, who's passed away, by the way, in 1999 at the age of 58, she finally moved from Culver City to Carson. Now, the media didn't know who she was. She would have made a terrible witness for numerous reasons, which we didn't want to discuss with the public. Shortly after moving into a new place, phenomena broke out there, and her neighbors, who knew nothing about her, she was embarrassed about this, her neighbors began having phenomena, poltergeist activity. We went out there, it's all in my book. Then she moved from there to San Bernardino, or Riverside, and it followed her there. More things, but slower, lower magnitude. Then she moved back to Texas. We lost track of her till the film came out in 83. By the time that happened, she said most of it had dissipated. However, one of my good friends, Javier Ortega, who runs the website ghosttheory.com, and he's republished some of my blogs, he did an interview with me and other people. He's also talked with all three of Doris's sons, and they've said that the phenomena kept happening around her until the day she died, but at a much lower level.
This sounds to me a lot like a case that we had here in the UK, the Enfield poltergeist case.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
That was
a world-famous event.
Well, I interviewed at his home Guy Lyon Playfair, who was one of the main researchers there, who lived with that family for 3 months. And this stuff did burn itself out in the end. The phenomena did come to a kind of end. But again, you had a young family. There were issues around the family, and these phenomena and events seemed to be somehow focused around them. Whatever it was drawn to them, channeling through them.
Okay, now, it's interesting, Howard. The thing we found, the most extraordinary patterns we found, I never would have suspected. Okay, these things appear to be the result of a confluence, not an influence, a confluence. One thing is the location, geomagnetic anomaly or electromagnetic anomaly. Two, most of these people, if not all of them, are either seizure-prone or epileptic, temporal lobe lability. When they take the meds to deal with their seizures, the seizures stop and the phenomena stop. They stop taking the meds because the meds make them feel really bad. Everything starts again. The third parameter here is emotions. And it seems the people with these who are wired badly, when they're in this environment, their bodies react to it. It stresses the body. The body responds by tearing the environment apart in a psychokinetic manner. However, while almost all the cases I looked at have fit this pattern, most people who are epileptic or seizure-prone are not poltergeist agents. But most people who are poltergeist agents are seizure-prone or epileptic.
So are you saying that there are certain afflicted people who have these problems and a door is more easily opened with these people than it would be with you or I?
Well, it's even more than that. You're correct, but it's even more so. It appears to be that, like we do know, let's say you're in good health. Okay, you got to go to your friend's house. Okay, they have kids. They're all sick. So you don't shake anyone's hand. You wear a mask. You wear gloves. You're very careful. You come home. You get sick. You give it to your family. We understand that. It's called contagion. It's a vectored virus or bacteria. We understand that. There may be something akin going on in the paranormal, but it's not biologic. It's a form of energy we do not yet understand and cannot measure. It may be that if you're susceptible to this, you go into that environment, this energy alters you, it contaminates you, for lack of a better term, and then you leave and it propagates from you away. You emit it away from the source. In my book, I talk about biological operational amplifiers, waveguides and focal planes, where some people are like antennas. They take this energy in, it alters them, they re-emit it under the right conditions, and we see the results.
So now, would you advise anybody who felt they might be particularly vulnerable to stay away from anywhere that they know might be, and again, it's a broad term, might be haunted, might be subject to apparitions?
The problem is, without the right instrumentation, you may never know what the environment is, because like we want to be on cases, you walk in the environment and you feel like your head's going to explode, and the 60 hertz noise from the bad wiring, just you feel like you fry an egg. It's very subtle. We had a case in 2005 and 6 in Beverly Hills, Cielo Drive. It was right down the street, literally doors down from where the Charles Manson killed Sharon Tate back in all her friends in 1969. The geomagnetic readings were anywhere from 12 to 100 times above normal. We saw psychokinetic manifestations, disembodied voices, luminous anomalies, the whole bit. And it's more than coincidental that that location is labeled an U.S. Geological Survey geomagnetic anomaly. What a coincidence.
So we're saying here that an awful lot of what we call phenomena, and a lot of people make a lot of money writing books and doing documentaries about all of this stuff, may actually have explanations that are rooted in the greater understanding of science.
Right. Instead of what we used to call supernatural, this would be called preternatural. So the science, the fiction of one generation becomes the science of the next. When we learn, and eventually the patterns will be so clear and demonstrable to where, oh, it's just this. It's going to be a radical and fundamental changing of the way we perceive energy, life and death, and information. In the end, we're not going to probably not going to like what we learn, but that's life.
Do you believe that?
The best way to describe,
do you believe that death is the end for you and I, or do you believe that we go on and we've been here before?
I don't think we begin at birth. I don't think we end at death. It's just transitioning from one level of reality to another. I have a really strong, I can't prove this, but I've uncovered evidence that one of the reasons I may be a medical intuitive, or I am a medical intuitive, is that I lived in another century and I was a medical doctor.
Right.
So can I prove it? No. The evidence show up that indicated it? Yes. Does that prove it? No. It's you know, the way you look at all this is simple. We're investigating and studying the effect of an unknown cause. Okay, it's sort of like you're seeing the wake produced by a boat in the water, but you can't see the boat. Another way would be, imagine the three blind men and the elephant. So one blind man is holding the elephant's trunk, and they think it's a hose. The other holds the elephant's leg and thinks it's a tree trunk. The third holds the elephant's tail and thinks it's a rope. They're all wrong. This is where we're at. And what's hurting this field more than anything is the glut of the paranormal reality shows on television, on cable television.
Why would that
be? They are doing a tremendous disservice to the field.
Why? Is that because of the trivialization factor or what?
Well, they're lying. They're and one of my blogs on my website, barrytaft.net, is called Circus Sideshow. You got a problem if you're producing an hour reality show. You can't have talking heads for 41 minutes. No, they don't allow that. So what do? One is you populate the show with a lot of crazy people who run around going nuts. Okay. Two is you embellish and exaggerate whatever might occur. But the big thing is you fake it. And these shows all fake it. One of my friends...
All of them?
Pardon?
All of them?
Lies. These shows are faking events. They're staging it. These are all engineered events. I can tell lots of stories about this.
Now, a different thing seems to happen over here whenever they do documentaries or big expositions of paranormal phenomena. They always seem to be under a directive, an editorial directive in this country, that they have to bring it back to the skeptic's viewpoint, and they'll build you up to a point where you think, my God, this stuff really exists. It's amazing. And then they have to bring you back to the point at the end where actually it's all garbage, really. And we learn nothing.
That's happened here a lot, Howard, a lot. They've had a lot of shows that they build you up. It's really good, what they say and how they put it together. And then in the end, they bring on the skeptics and debunkers. Oh, it's all a bunch of crap.
And we learn nothing. We come out of it having learned absolutely nothing. And it does, to people who are casually interested in this stuff, not as interested as you and I are, it does nobody a great service at all.
Oh, right. You know, there are a number of large groups that fund debunkers, the professional debunkers. Part of them is the Defense Department. Another group that funds them are pharmaceutical companies.
Now, why would the Department of Defense do that? Is that because they have access to some of this stuff and they don't want you to know about it?
Well, it's a multiple thing, but on my website, one of my blogs is called Disinforming the Paranormal and Ufology. And the whole point is they don't want the people empowered. Remember, the dumber we are, the more ignorant we are, the easier we are to manipulate. And therefore, to keep people stupid, just living their daily lives, don't worry about things. When it comes to ufology, UFOs, there is more evidence for UFOs in terms of their presence and what's been going on for a long time than there is for the paranormal. The problem is we don't know who and where and why. We just know these things have been happening.
Do you think we're going to find any keys on Mars? Do you think, because we seem to be being built up for something on Mars, do you think we're going to find any keys to any of this stuff there?
Mars, my strong sense is telling me, what I've read and taught people I've talked to, there is a faction of the government that knows what's going on regarding UFOs, a very small faction. And, you know, all they care about in the end, Howard, all they care about is domestic tranquility to maintain peace of mind of people. So come April 15th, we write that damn check to the IRS. That's all they care about.
I tell you something,
if
Barry.
If domestic tranquility fails, there's chaos.
I find that very, very hard to disagree with, Barry. I think that's there's a very good argument to be made for that.
If we already have a problem between black and white and red, yellow and brown here. You want to throw gray in the mix? Could you imagine what would happen if suddenly it was proven to the world population that the human race was engineered by another race of beings about 2 million years ago.
Well, people would, first of all, stop having faith in the things that they've had faith in before, like religion, like governments, I would assume.
Exactly.
Listen, Barry, we're running out of time here. I want to do this again with you because I think I've only scratched the surface with you. But please, in these last couple of minutes, tell me about your current book.
Okay, my book is called Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, Explorations of the Unknown. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's also at www.cosmicpantheon.com. And my website is barrytaft.net. I have 63 published blogs regarding my work, from ufology to the paranormal and everything in between. It won't bore you.
You have a great website. I've loved looking at your website.
Thank you. So
give me, if you can, give me a 2-minute synopsis of what the book's about. I'm really sorry. We need to go into this next time we talk, and I hope there is a next time. We need to go into it more deeply. But just give me the two-minute
sell. The book is about, there's three sections. The first section is called, ghosts, apparitions, hauntings, and poltergeists. The second is UFOs, abductions, and EBEs. The third section is space-time, consciousness, and the paranormal. It's trying to tie all these things together in a way so when you're done reading my book, you know a lot more than you did before you read it, and you have some degree of education while you're entertained. That's the whole point. I didn't write the book to scare people. I wrote them, this is what the evidence indicates. This is where the data is taking us. This is what we know now.
Well, let me tell you, the reason you're on this show is because one of my listeners suggested you and said, you are going to love Barry Taff, and I think you'll really get on with him, and I think he'll be great for your show. And that person was absolutely on the money. Amazing,
so thank you.
Barry.
My pleasure.
But we have to do this again because I think we've probably talked about 10% of the things we could have talked about. So I want to do the other 90% or certainly get round to some of that material the next time we talk. But I hope that you feel this has done you justice, Barry.
Oh, yes, Howard. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Barry Taff.
Thank you.
Well, I've only got one word to say after that, and that word is wow. The world of Dr. Barry Taff. Let me know what you thought about him as a guest and any impressions of any of the shows we've done. Go to the website www.theunexplained.tv, the website designed by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. And there you can send me email about the show or you can make a donation to it by clicking on the yellow donate button and all donations gratefully received. And your thoughts on this show and the way that I'm doing it, as I say, gratefully received. Thank you very much for keeping the faith with The Unexplained. I've got more great shows in the pipeline. We hope to be doing even more as this year goes by, so watch this space. Keep coming back to the website, www.theunexplained.tv, and we will make things happen here together. Thank you very much for your support. My name is Howard Hughes in London. This has been The Unexplained, and I will return here soon. Take care.